What happens when a coping technique that's meant to calm anxiety is only a temporary fix? As you know, coping strategies can be useful, but sometimes we need to address the root of anxiety on a deeper level. Dr. Sue Johnson is about to share a personal story of how her own anxiety illustrates this important point. But first, let's look at exactly what coping techniques have in common with couple skills and why both are sometimes ineffective for clients.
I think it's easiest to start with what we don't do in EFT. We don't coach people with coping techniques because it's a bit like teaching couple skills. They can only use them when they don't matter, when they're not all caught up in the fight or the emotions. So we don't teach people those. What we do, and it's interesting that CBT is more and more going into mindfulness, which is all about awareness and tolerating the emotion, because that's what we've been doing for a long time. That's what all experiential therapists do. We go in and we join people in that anxiety, but we do it in a regulated way. I'm creating safety at the same time. I stay within people's window of tolerance. You know, with her, with my last client, you know, I went in and we talked about what comes up for her in the here and now, in the present, when she remembers sitting around the table with her husband and her husband's family and everyone speaking in this foreign language, and her asking her husband, could you please ask people to speak English sometimes? And he just looks at her and continues to speak in the foreign language. And what was happening with her, and of course what's happening is amazing anxiety is coming up, and she still has it, of I'm not good enough to be included, my needs don't matter, I'm something wrong with me, I should be able to learn this language, right? All these dreadful feelings of inadequacy come up, and anxiety. So I stay with her in that, we walk around in it, but I support her and validate her, and I keep reflecting what she's feeling, and the reflection calms people down because they feel seen and heard. We help them make sense of their emotions. We put them in an attachment frame. So it's kind of like you start to ground people. The emotion isn't overwhelming anymore. You're working on a little piece of it with the therapist. It starts to make more sense. And as you do that, people begin to process it differently in the here and now. They start to process it differently. And, you know, then they come up with coping techniques. They say, you know, she says, so, you know, I'm starting to understand that some part of me is still that little girl sitting on my father's knee wanting to say, Daddy, Daddy, I won the prize in the running competition. But he said, but you only came second. Right? So I'm still that little girl. I say, yes, and let's be with that little girl for a moment. She's so scared and she's so sad. And so I stay with people. You help them process it and regulate it in the moment. And they start to change their relationship with their anxiety. They don't feel so overwhelmed by it. They understand it. They can listen to the important information in it. Emotion tells us a lot about where we are in the world, what matters to us. You know, it orientates us. So emotion doesn't become the enemy anymore. People can stand alongside their anxiety and say, I'm anxious. You know, I'm anxious.
What Sue just said reinforces something that Dr. Shelley Harrell talked about in Module 2. Anxiety can reveal what matters to us. But in order for this to happen, our relationship with anxiety needs to shift away from fear and toward curiosity. Now, we've prepared a special bonus for you. It's going to give you a step-by-step process to help couples explore the anxiety between them with curiosity. So for couples and individuals, approaching anxiety with open interest, with curiosity, is important. And it's important for us as practitioners as well. Which brings us back to Sue's personal story that I mentioned a few moments ago. You see, much like what Stephen Hayes talked about in Module 4, Sue also came to understand anxiety partly because of her own experience with it.
When I worked with my airplane phobia, I worked with it for years, I'm a psychologist, so I did every coping technique known to man. I had every piece of insight, every, okay? And I reduced it by about 50%, but it was still bad. And what blew my mind, this is so funny because I believe in going and processing your emotion, was I finally went to this therapist, and she was very different, and she did the obvious, which I had never done, which is to say, see, she comes in with me and she explores it with me. She doesn't give me a way to cope. I've got 1,000 of those. She says, could you help me when you're actually sitting on the plane? You don't actually think the plane's going to crash, do you? I said, no, no. She says, you're not actually afraid of heights, are you? I said, no, no. So then we go through all this, and she says, so what is it? I say, well, I'm flying off. I'm usually flying off by myself to some, especially years ago, I'm flying off by myself to some strange city to meet all these strange people to talk about something they don't want to hear about. And I'm flying. She says, oh, you're flying off by yourself. Hey, I'm an attachment person and I don't see my own attachment. And I say, yes. And so then, bless her heart, because this isn't her orientation at all, but she's a flexible therapist. She says, and what memories do you have of feeling kind of vulnerable and alone and unseen and being all by yourself, going off on your own? And I was blown away to remember the fact that when I was 4 years old, lived in a different world, when I was 4 years old, I was given to another girl who was about 8, who I didn't know. And my mother said, get on this bus. You'll go into the town. You stay with her. Her name was Diane. You stay with Diane. Then you go down a street, down another street. You get on another bus. And you go to the school. And the kids in the school all have different accents. And they look different than you. And they're richer than you. And they're Catholic. And you do what you're told. And this is what you'll do every day. And I suddenly, for the first time in my life, had this overwhelming feeling of what that must have been like for a four-year-old, and how that is exactly the same feeling as I would have when I was going to the airport and my stomach started to churn. So could you say that's insight? Not really. It is insight, but it was a new emotional experience, a corrective emotional experience for me to tune into that. That was her putting all her techniques aside. She was a behaviorist. You know, I wanted some more techniques, right? So that was her putting all her techniques aside and just coming and being with me and staying with me and walking around in this emotional territory and finding what comes up. And guess what? Mind-boggling. It really changed. I mean, it really changed everything, because I don't have that feeling in my stomach now when I go to the airport. I think coping and teaching techniques are very limited. I think you have to go into your anxiety with someone you trust and have a corrective experience of making sense of that anxiety and regulating it differently. And then you've changed your relationship. And now I feel competent too. If I do get anxious in a plane, I can use one of the techniques because it's qualitatively different, you know. And I use an attachment technique. I listen to my husband's voice in my head, because I believe that that's much more powerful than just breathing or doing mindfulness. I just listen to my husband's voice, because our nervous system is tuned to the messages from those we love. That's a most natural, unconditioned, soothing device known to man.
For Sue, coping strategies were indeed helpful, but only after she got to the heart of her phobia. Now, to build on this, let's turn to Dr. Rick Hansen. In many ways, Rick agrees with Sue about the challenges that can sometimes go along with relying too heavily on coping strategies. But here he describes two ways to increase the effectiveness of those strategies for our clients.
Well, I have enormous respect for Dr. Johnson, period, and that work in that territory. And I think she's done a really huge contribution for the field, drawing our attention to the primacy of emotion including social emotions and very primal social emotions that are grounded in early attachment experiences. I think that is certainly central. On the other hand, I think this here is also an example of that matter of flat statements that I brought up at the very beginning. In other words, in my own view, what we're talking about here is actually described in other ways as the transfer of skill from one setting to another setting, or the generalization of a useful perspective or insight from one particular time and place or relationship to other times and places and relationships. And very broadly, there's tremendous amount of evidence that if people are unable to transfer a skill they've acquired, let's say in their therapist's office or reading a book, to when the stakes are really high, there are many, many ways in which to increase that transfer of skill. Just because that's an issue doesn't mean necessarily and flatly that we should not focus on developing skills of various kinds, including coping skills, in the first place. So then the question becomes, how do we help people expand the range in which they can draw upon their inner resources as the challenges around them rise? That's the fundamental question. And there are many ways to do that. One way is, of course, through imagined practice. And there are many therapeutic methods that draw on that fundamental strategy, where you're with someone with a very, secure base of where they feel solid and stable and resourced and able to do it. Draw on their capabilities or, let's say, coping skills. And then you have them imagine one step more challenging situation and tolerate and allow the natural upsetting emotions they might have. And in their imagination, imagine still practicing and keeping it together with their skills, even when they're a little rattled. I think it's easy in life to draw on our capabilities when we're utterly calm and utterly confident, but we also need to be able to function and remain resilient when we're still pretty rattled and we're not so sure, but we still are plucky and we keep going, we keep trying, we keep working it out. That territory is very, very important. So we can do it in imagined practice, and then also we encourage people to do things in terms of this idea of transfer of skills or generalization of capability in reality. Doing little tests, doing little experiments. Again, there's so many therapeutic methods that are about that. Expanding the range in which you can keep functioning. And then, really critically important, when you do expand that range to the next step out, register that you're capable. Register the benefits of stretching and reaching. Register the knowledge that you can really keep doing this. And then once that's established and stabilized, you build out from there. And of course, adapt to individual needs. So I'm very hopeful about those possibilities to really feel that you can indeed expand the range in which you can cope, even if you're still experiencing a lot of anxiety.
Through practice in imagination, as well as practice out in the world, Rick believes that clients can learn to transfer coping skills from the calm of the office to the chaos of their real life. Now let's look back at Sue's story about her own airplane phobia one more time, because it raises an important question. When and what should we disclose to our clients about our own lives and experiences? To dive into that, here are Drs. Ron Siegel and Kelly McGonigal again.
I really appreciated Sue sharing her story, first of all. I thought that it was a great story, and it reminded me of, there have been some surveys that show that even many cognitive behavior therapists will turn toward more psychodynamic or more exploratory psychotherapies when they're in distress themselves, because there is something about connecting to the pain that we didn't see when we were first with the anxious symptom. But once we connect with what is underneath it or attached to it or associated to it, that transforms the feeling of anxiety in a way that really is more profound, at least in my experience, than all the stuff that I think is also important, like learning to be courageous, learning to feel it, not trying to avoid it, and even examining, the nature of our perhaps irrational thoughts about it. So I happen to be temperamentally anxious. I've revealed that here before. And this is despite a reasonably good attachment history. You know, maybe not a lot of talking about emotions when I was young, but I certainly have a lot of images of, you know, loving, caring moments, including, you know, the skinned knee and being held and comforted. So, you know, it's interesting. When I'm anxious, I'll often try to investigate it very much in the way that Sue did. And I think I mentioned this here too, you know, I'll often find sadness underneath. And it's very interesting that as soon as I've connected to that sadness, the anxiety tends to transform, even if the external issue hasn't changed at all. And I'll tell patients about this, and I'll tell them that it informs my bias about what might be going on for them. And I'll say, you know, there's a little secret, you know, therapists, even though we're professionally trained, it's the things that we've seen in our own hearts and minds to be transformative. Those are the things that we tend to want to share with the people we're working with. So I don't know if this is true for you, but this is how I've seen it work for me. And I'll do it more so even, you know, with guys, if it's the traditional, you know, learning not to cry. I was just recently, you know, out in a public place, and I saw the 6-year-old kid who was trying to lug a package that he was carrying for his dad, and it was too heavy, and he broke down crying, you know, "Daddy, it's too heavy, I can't do it." And then his, like, 9-year-old brother comes along and says, "You're such a sissy, stop whining." And I thought, that's it. It's all over, was my thought, you know, and it doesn't have to be that determining, but when it's this kind of classic, culturally synchronous kind of difficulty, I'll often self-disclose around it and talk to people around it. And I find that they find it helpful, that they find that it's normalizing, and then they're open to looking at it. And it also helps to diffuse two levels of shame, both the shame that I have this vulnerable feeling and the shame that I'm neurotic and due to this vulnerable feeling, I'm having this anxiety symptom. And if we can normalize both of those, I think that makes it easy. And also becomes a motivator because, you know, who in their right mind would want to feel more vulnerable unless it was like, oh, because if I felt more vulnerable, I'd be more connected and less chronically anxious. Well, then it's worth feeling more vulnerable. So it's kind of modeling that this may be a worth it kind of a bargain.
Yeah, well, this is a lesson I've had to learn over my career, the willingness to self-disclose. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but my first book was about chronic pain. And it wasn't until I published that book that the majority of people in my life knew I had pain. Even my own students, I was teaching a class for people with chronic pain, and they were like, "You have pain? So I'm really bad at self-disclosing." And one of the reasons I decided to start talking more about my own experience with anxiety, that fear of flying since Sue mentioned it, that is the single thing I've self-disclosed that has appeared to be the most effective in terms of helping other people, not necessarily helping myself, although it actually has. But the reason I started to self-disclose that is the first magazine profile that was written about me was by someone who had taken a 5-week course with me about willpower. And the way that she described me in this profile was, you know, she has it all together. She doesn't have any willpower struggles. It's hard to imagine, you know, blah, blah. And the example she gave was this really trivial example. I think I might have mentioned offhand about still getting anxious before every time I teach a class, which of course is true. And that was like the only example she could draw on that I might have any willpower challenges. And I was so horrified by that because it was such a gap between I imagined people would view me as a mess all the time, not the opposite. So I realized it was important to self-disclose intentionally to give other people permission to be more honest about their struggles. And, you know, so how I decide what to disclose and when to disclose is to make sure that it's not intended to serve any function for me, that it's not about unburdening my soul or, you know, wanting to share, that it feels in service of others, and that it won't create issues around intimacy or perceived competence. I mean, I'm very aware of not wanting a disclosure to create a sense of threat in others, like, I'm a little uncomfortable knowing that much about this person. So that's how I make the decision. But I found that particularly with, you know, anxiety, it creates courage. I've heard from so many students who will think of me in my moments of fear and trying to be brave when they need to be brave in the way that we talked about calling in social support. And I've heard from many people that thinking about me being scared is actually a social support, as opposed to maybe me giving them a pep talk in their head.
I would just add a slight modifier to that, what I think is an excellent list of sort of checklist prior to self-disclosing, which is simply the word mostly. You know, yeah. That it's not mostly about self-treatment. It's not mostly about all those different things. Because I think it's a very high bar to have any of our actions feel like they're, you know, they're purely for the other.
But I know, like, I can remember one time I think I went too far. And there was a sense of, there was a kind of energy to it when I was sharing it that felt interpersonal as opposed to professional. And in the work that I do, that was too much. And I think if I'd done it in a therapeutic setting, it also would have been too much. So that's what I'm looking for, that feeling. Like you said, it's mostly. And when you go past that edge, you can sense it, I think.
Yeah, it is interesting that I don't know exactly how to, well, there's a certain anxiety, I think, that happens when we're doing it, because there's a sense that, we're not actually on task here anymore.
As Ron and Kelly just said, there are many factors to keep in mind when we're deciding what and when to share with someone else. As we've seen so far in this program, personal stories from Dr. Stephen Hayes in Module 4 and from Sue in this module, personal stories can be enormously helpful. In the next module, we'll get into another expert's take on the anxiety equation that we discussed with Dr. Christine Podesky, and we'll examine one question that really gets to the heart of anxiety treatment. I'll see you there.